My first guest will be State Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who represents the 63rd Assembly District, which covers western Racine County. And we did the interview in Assembly Speaker Voss's office in Madison. And then segment two will be the Superintendent of Schools in Elkhorn, Jason Tadlock. I'm sitting in the offices of Speaker of the Wisconsin State Assembly, Robin Voss, here in the state capitol. Speaker Voss, welcome again to Education Matters.
Thanks very much, Steve. I always enjoy it, and I'm glad you could make it to Madison to actually do the interview today. Thanks for doing that.
I know. It's much better than doing it on the telephone.
It's definitely a prettier venue, no doubt about that.
How about a status report on how you think things went this past legislative session in general and also as it relates to education?
Sure. Well, of course, we are just now ending our legislative session, so we've been in for a little bit over a year. We start going back way to the beginning where Governor Walker introduced his budget. If you recall, in the beginning, he actually reduced some funding for K-12 education. Luckily, the legislature, working together, restored all of that money and actually increased funding for education, which was, a really good victory for K-12. One of the things that we also saw is that Governor Walker proposed a pretty big cut to the UW system. We weren't able to restore all of that cut, but we were able to reduce the size of the cut. So I was disappointed that we had to really reduce funding to the university at all, to be quite honest. I also know that we were successful from my venue in having school choice expanded statewide and doing it in a way that mirrors what occurs right now in open enrollment. So open enrollment is the program where any resident of Wisconsin who lives inside of a school district can choose to go to another public school as long as there's space. The exact same thing is my goal for a private school. So if you live in Burlington, you'd have the opportunity to go to Union Grove or Waterford or maybe the Catholic school or the Lutheran school or the private school. So I think that was something that I'm pretty happy that we were able to get done. We also had an opportunity to talk about school accountability. That was one of my disappointments. If you remember at the beginning of the session, I pushed just about as hard as I could to try to have a common report card where students who were in a private or a public school would be subject to similar tests and similar accountability measures, and those that would fail, public or private, we would have to have some kind of sanctions to make them improve or, you know, potentially they would close. It's one of the only times where I really saw school choice advocates and public school choice or public school advocates on the same side where they did not want increased accountability for the most part. So unfortunately, I was not successful in their area. That was disappointing. But I also know that we did pass some other things which allowed us to make sure we have better report cards that are more reflective of poverty and ensuring that we actually have a better understanding of what happens inside a school district. We made sure that we had more accountability as far as, you know, what happens inside of a school district, if there's crime or not, so parents can make those educated decisions. And I think that by and large, we did an awful lot of things this session that people are proud of. You know, outside of education, of course, balanced the budget, made sure that we had property taxes basically frozen, 70-mile-an-hour speed limit dealt with heroin and opiate abuse. I mean, lots of things. Alzheimer's and dementia, of course, lots of things that people can look at and say, should these be part of what we did?
One of the things that you brought up in terms of assessment, there's a new assessment exam that will be in place this next school year. It's still tied into the Common Core. What's the current status here in Wisconsin with the Common Core in terms of what school districts must do?
We know that when Common Core was adopted by the federal consortium, they encouraged states all around the country to adopt the common standards. Now, as far as having a common standard, I actually agree that we should have minimum standards for every single state. What I would ask is that the way that Common Core has developed, it seems like it is a top-down mandate where an awful lot of parents don't want to say that somebody outside their school district should be making that decision. So luckily in Wisconsin, Tony Evers signed the agreement, but it's not binding on any of the school districts. So we passed legislation inside the budget that just reiterates that each school district has the right to decide for themselves if they want to or don't want to be part of Common Core. I think that you're right, that while the goal of Common Core to have common standards is something that I think most people support, the way that it's been developed has left a lot of parents with concerns on both the right and the left end of the spectrum. So a lot of misinformation, but hopefully by having that local school district option, which is really where we are, that kind of solves the problem to allow parents and schools to decide what's best for themselves.
What do you see as the future role of DPI? And then maybe if you could tie into that, what kind of overall grade would you give the Department of Public Instruction?
Well, of course, in our Constitution, we have the Department of Public Instruction, which is given protections because it is a department that was established at statehood. I think that just goes to show that the founders of our state knew that public education was not only important for our own state, but to have a lively, informed citizenry and hopefully an enlightened government. I think that by and large, I would say DPI is a C. I think that there are far too many children who are statewide who are failing. I think that we see school districts that are not educating kids the way that you and I would want them to. I think you and I would probably also agree that there is no greater potential advantage for a student than having a really good education that they can build on with some kind of training or college degree to make sure that they don't need government programs, don't need government services, and can be self-sufficient. So I think that if you look at what's happening in Milwaukee or Racine or some of the really urban districts, I think it's disappointing, and I think that DPI should be doing a lot more to try to incentivize and encourage them to do better for every single child. In certain parts of the state, I think they're doing just fine. I think that there are many school districts where we see kids are advancing, but also with the assessments that we're going to have, we're going to first time now with basically hopefully a test that isn't going to change, because we had that happen far too often where we adopt a test and then change it. Hopefully by having a test that we can have multiple years' results, we'll actually be able to see whether or not districts are progressing or not, and then parents will be able to help force districts to either improve or potentially make dramatic changes.
If you were, instead of being Speaker Voss, if you were Governor Voss, would you want to see the state superintendent of DPI be appointed versus elected?
No, well, the one thing I can promise you is that there'll never be a Governor Voss, at least not me. Maybe my kids someday. But what I can say is, look, I believe in the constitutional ability of the DPI superintendent to continue to advocate for public education. I do. I think that by and large, I almost always prefer an elected official to an appointed one. I think that they're more responsive. But I will also say that the way that the process has gone, it would be awfully nice if the Department of Public Instruction focused mostly on the kids and their results as opposed to the adults and their benefits. And it seems like far too many times they focus on the adults and they don't really think about the ramifications for kids, their education, how they're going to actually be able to improve over time. And definitely think about 20 years from now when a child is graduating from high school who's been born today, as opposed to thinking about the adults who are nearing retirement and that's what they're worried about.
You mentioned about school choice and open enrollment, and you also mentioned about school choice in terms of private or parochial schools. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's always controversial. It's always something that brings up a lot of discussion in terms of using our taxpayer dollars for private and parochial schools. Where do you see that in the next 5 years going here in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, I hope we finally found a consensus that people can buy into. So almost 20 years ago when we began the concept of open enrollment, there were a lot of people on the left especially who were opposed to the idea of open enrollment, that kids should go to the public schools in their neighborhood. That's what's best for them. But I think now gradually people have accepted the fact that if there's a public school that folks think is better for their kids, it shouldn't matter if it's Union Grove or Waterford or Burlington, as long as we get a good education. And I think that's the way that we're going now with the younger generation, where, you know, they're used to technology. They're used to a lot of choices. They can pick Uber or Airbnb, and they can decide what's best for themselves because they have the data. I think that as long as we have good data, a lot of families are going to choose that same thing through the open enrollment process to go to a private school. Now, even in Indiana, where they have statewide school choice without basically any limits, I think it's almost 90% of the kids still go to a traditional public school. So I don't ever see a time where the vast, vast majority of children will not still be in a public school. But I think giving people more choices in the environment that we're in improves everyone's options and also the accountability that we expect of everybody who uses tax dollars, public or private.
You recently took some issue with school districts that, as you put it, are pocketing the difference through higher property taxes and some of the issues right now with the legislation and the revenue limits. Maybe if you can talk a bit about that.
So as I mentioned with this open enrollment concept, when we passed the budget, it was my clear understanding that the goal was to mirror the program as closely as we possibly could. So under that, you were allowed to levy for the state aid. So as an example, let's just make up an example. If you spend $10,000 per child and you are 50% aided, that means 50% comes from the state and 50% comes from property taxes. Under the way that open enrollment works, $6,700 approximately follows the child to another public school, and the balance stays with the district where they are formally educating the child. That's the same way I assumed that it was going to work with the school choice system, where money would follow the child and a portion would remain back with the district. Because of what I think is a drafting error, they were allowed to count 100% in the very first year, which is why we saw Racine Unified with almost an 11% property tax increase. They literally taxed to the max as much as they could. So we passed legislation in the Assembly. I think it's going to pass the Senate as well, that basically will allow them to recoup the entire cost of the scholarship that a child uses to attend a private school through a combination of state aid and local property taxes, but not the skim above the cost to educate that child. So I think if you talk to most folks, it's a reasonable compromise. It protects the property taxpayer and guarantees that the school district doesn't lose one nickel from a choice child, but it also ensures that we go back to closer of what the intent was than what actually happened in the budget.
In fact, when I interviewed Senator Olson a few weeks ago, we did talk about that, and as you just said, you just mentioned that RUSD will actually only lose about $1.4 million, although I think they're saying $1.8 million in a news article. But this idea of finding common ground, if you will, and the quote that you said that this was a win-win for both taxpayers and the local school district, that's pretty unusual in 2016, isn't it?
Well, unfortunately, it is far too often, but I think that's more of what happens in Madison than people realize. 94% of the bills that we pass this legislative session pass with bipartisan support. And I think if you ask most people that and you said you argue only about 6% of the bills, yeah, for the most part, that's about true. Because most of the time we can find that common ground. We all want to invest more in schools. We all want to have the very best education we can. But I hope we also want to protect proper taxpayers, and it's always the struggle. So I think that this bill, while not perfect, it's not everything I wanted, it's not everything Senator Olson wanted, or perhaps even some of my Democratic colleagues, I think it's a common sense middle ground that does both. Because when they say they're losing $1.4 to $1.8 million, they're not losing anything. That's the amount of money they won't be able to recoup from property taxes. So they're still able to raise property taxes. It's not zero. It's just not anywhere near as much as they had hoped for.
Changing the subject from property taxes to concealed carry, I know there was some effort put onto the floor, a discussion and a bill about concealed carry on campus. And you're quoted as saying that you support in general the idea. I guess my question for you is, if that were to pass and become law here in the state, how would you see that actually being managed?
Well, there was two different bills, of course, one dealing with college campuses and the tech schools. That one, I think, where you have all the adults involved, I think it'll be no different than anywhere else you walk. If you go into Target today or you go into the mall, most of the time people can have a concealed carry weapon because it's constitutional and it's legal. And I think we've had no issues with that. So I think it's kind of a red herring to some extent. There was another bill which would allow people to conceal carry inside a public school. I also, frankly, would support that, but I also know that that makes a lot more folks nervous. So the issue that has been brought up to me for the most part is to say that under current law, if you have a concealed carry weapon because you're allowed to carry it at work or you want to carry it for your own protection, and you drop off a child at school because you're on the school grounds, even though you never get out of the car, you're committing a crime. Well, that seems silly to me. So I certainly think we should at least correct that. That's the least we should do. But I also think we want to look and say, if somebody has gone through actual training with a weapon, they've guaranteed that they know how to use it, I don't have a problem with that inside of a school as long as the people are trained and able to handle it. Do I think that it's going to be, the Wild West again? I don't. We heard those kind of complaints when we had concealed carry come forward, and it hasn't happened 4 or 5 years later. So it's not the highest priority, as I said, for the legislature. I don't hear a ton of people clamoring to be able to carry a weapon inside school. But I do hear a lot of folks that say, I don't want to be breaking the law when I drop off my kids at school. So hopefully we'll come back next spring and we'll have a consensus on that just like the others.
I couldn't let you get away. Of course, I'm in your office, so you can throw me out anytime. But let's talk a little bit about national politics. In a recent meeting that you had with the Racine Journal-Times with her editorial board, you said that you did not rule out supporting Donald Trump for the presidency, but you questioned his conservative credentials, and you put out a report very recently about this current session of the legislature being a very conservative agenda that essentially got passed by the assembly and by the total legislature. Maybe if you could talk more about what you meant about actually questioning Donald Trump's his credentials as a conservative.
Well, as you know, Steve, I started my involvement in the Republican Party when I was 10 years old. Lee Sherman Dreyfus, 1978. And I got addicted because I realized that it's one of the only places that you could actually make a real difference to your neighbors, your friends, and society. So I have long had a pretty clear understanding of what it means to be a conservative because I am one. I want to make sure that we know that everybody who's a conservative understands that government is supposed to be the last resort, not the first resort. You know, we want to rely more on people who are privately motivated, private individuals who have charity, people who are self-sufficient that might need some help. I'm not against help for folks who are downtrodden, but it should never be that hammock that lasts far too long so they get into a bad lifestyle. I think I also want somebody who respects traditional values, that has the same belief system that I do, that respects the fact that some people are religious and some aren't, and doesn't, you know, say that one is more important than the other. And, you know, one of my political heroes is Ronald Reagan, and he was a Democrat for much of his life. But he had a conversion where he actually looked and said, you know what, I've realized that what the Democratic Party stands for isn't what I stand for. I've never heard Donald Trump say that. I've never heard him say, the reason that I gave money to all these Democrats, the reason that I voted for Barack Obama was because I thought they were wrong right at the time, and now I know they weren't. It's hard for me to believe that you could vote for Barack Obama and now 8 years later say that you repudiate everything he believes in if you actually have a core set of beliefs. So I certainly am, obviously, I'm proud to be the co-chair of Marco Rubio's campaign for the state. I think he's optimistic, he's hopeful, he's visionary. He is a bright, articulate leader that I am proud to support. I believe in the primary process, so we'll have to wait and see what happens. I'm going to do everything that I physically can to make sure that Marco Rubio is the nominee. But if for some reason he's not, I'll look at where Donald Trump is at the time. I'll look what he stands for. And I'll have to make a decision at that point. But as I said before, I've voted for every Republican since I could vote for president. You know, I presume that's where I'll be, but I guess I'm going to have to wait and see.
With respect to the next legislative session, what are two or three of the top agenda items on your list for the state assembly and for the entire legislature?
Probably my biggest disappointment this session is that we haven't figured out a way to fund transportation. Whether you like it or not, when Barack Obama became the president of the United States, he changed the mile standards for how many miles per gallon every car would get. And now we've been seeing, you know, less and less gas consumed, which is good for you and I as consumers, but it's bad for the transportation fund when it's almost entirely generated by revenue sold off gas taxes. So we have basically a flat transportation system with increasing needs. So we tried very hard. I support tolling. A lot of folks don't, but I believe in a user fee system. I certainly think we need more revenue in transportation, and we could not find consensus. So that was a problem that I hope we can solve next time. I would like to make sure that we continue to put more money in public education. I think that we need to have the ability for school districts to be able to deal with the crises that we see in a lot of families around the state. You know, we have poverty in every part of Wisconsin, and we know that the way out of poverty is a good education. Now, we are lucky that Act 10 worked. We were able to save a lot of money for school districts, but that was 5 years ago. So now we need to look and say, how do we ensure that going forward, districts have the resources that they need to guarantee every child in the state has a good education. And then I would say lastly, this session we did some good bipartisan things. We did a speaker's task force on Alzheimer's and dementia. Alzheimer's is the number six killer of Americans in the country. It's the only one in the top 10 without a cure and treatment. So that's an area where I want to continue our focus on mental health, on doing things for people who have Alzheimer's. But there are a lot of other needs, corrections reform, you know, trying to say when you get out of prison, you should have an opportunity to turn your life around, not just be, you know, wearing a scarlet letter because you made a mistake. So I think there's a lot of things that the legislature has left to do when we come back. But certainly, you know, those will be on the top of my list.
The task force that you created on issues in urban education, I mean, that covers early childhood, teacher recruitment, mental health, and the whole area of recruiting good new teachers into the state and keeping them. What do you see coming out of the task force?
Well, as we sit here today in my office, there's actually a meeting in Eau Claire. So our Urban Education Task Force has gone all around the state. They've been in Racine and Kenosha, listening to the needs. And we know that, of course, poverty is a huge factor, especially in urban districts. It's in all districts, but especially urban ones. So they have come to us saying that they might have some special needs. So if you remember 2 years ago, I did one on rural schools where we had a good group of folks, Democrats and Republicans, propose a number of ideas, more money for sparsity aid, more money for broadband, trying to do cross-grade sharing so some teachers might have an opportunity to, you know, teach in more than one district. I think some of those ideas were really good, and they were all passed into law. Here we sit with special needs that we have for urban districts, and I'm anxious to see what Representative Rodriguez and the Democrats and Republicans on her committee come forward with. And the goal of that is to not necessarily pass a single bill, but to hopefully take those good ideas and work with Governor Walker to get them in the next state budget so we can put some resources behind the ideas that they discover throughout their work on the task force.
Speaker Voss, I want to thank you for taking your time in your office today, and hopefully we'll have you as a guest in the near future here on Education Matters.
I always enjoy it, Steve. Thanks very much for your questions, and thanks to the audience for listening.
And we will have representatives from the Democratic Party in both the Assembly and the Senate with respect to education on future editions of Education Matters. And we continue now with Education Matters here on WGTD HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn and Lake Geneva. And we are actually in Elkhorn, and I'm sitting in the administrative offices of Superintendent Jason Tadlock. And Jason, the last time we interviewed, you were the district administrator in Wheatland.
Correct. Yeah, that just seems like yesterday. It was a few years ago.
Well, first of all, you know, our listeners know all about the districts in Kenosha and Racine, but why don't you tell us a bit about the community, and then also maybe if we start off with just talking about the Elkhorn School District.
The Elkhorn community is the county seat of Walworth County, so along with that, it brings a number of benefits. We have obviously the county courthouse and a lot of the employees here in town. We're about 10,000 strong. We also have a gateway campus that's located here in Elkhorn, which is a benefit to the students and the community as well. We also happen to have the Walworth County Fairgrounds, which is actually three of our schools surround the Walworth County Fairgrounds, and it brings in a lot of traffic to the community. It's nice location in that we're right off of Interstate 43 and Highway 12, so it's similar to a bedroom community in many ways, in that a lot of the families that live here commute to either Milwaukee or to Madison, Janesville, Rockford, you know, even some down to the Chicago area. So it's really a hub and went through a lot of growth in the past decade to bring us up to, you know, again, about 10,000 residents. And our school size is similar to that of Central Wastosha, Wilmot, and Lake Geneva. We're just slightly smaller. It's a wonderful town, close-knit community, but because of the growth, very open to new families and new community members as well.
What kinds of cooperative programs do you have with Gateway?
Well, we have a lot of cooperative programs with Gateway. Probably at the forefront of my mind is a lot of the course articulations that we have, the classes that students take. We both on our high school campus or on the Gateway campus. So, for example, we have approximately 50 to 60 students who go and participate in welding courses every semester over at the Gateway campus. We have a Gateway counselor, for lack of a better term, who comes in and works with students and helping with course planning and opportunities that they have that they can participate in. We also have a charter school, which is located on the Gateway campus, and that's approximately 100 students strong and serves the Walworth County school districts in a consortium. So Lake Geneva, Bigfoot, Williams Bay, and Elkhorn send students to the alternative high school, and they attend there in the building that's on the campus, and then they also all take a class from Gateway as well.
Are there students at the high school who are taking some general education courses at Gateway that can then be transferred as part of the articulation agreements into, let's say, into UW-Madison or UW-Whitewater or Parkside?
Yes, absolutely. There's quite a few course selections that students can take and receive credit through the UW system.
If we could take a few minutes and if you could just talk about the schools in the district.
We have three elementary schools, and all three of our elementary schools are of exceptionally high quality. They perform very well on the achievement assessments and the school ratings back when we had the school report card. They're led by three wonderful principals, and their teaching staff is phenomenal. And we've been really working hard in the district to continue that tradition of excellence that each of the schools have. We've implemented a one-to-one computing program. That's every kid has access to a laptop. We use Chromebooks starting in kindergarten all the way through fifth grade in the elementary schools. In third grade, they have the opportunity to take those home if they're families or parents, you know, don't want them to take them home, they can leave them there at school. We also have a comprehensive science, technology, engineering, and math program that's embedded in each of our elementaries. And that includes a computer science strand, a engineering strand, and a biomedical science strand as well. And if you've ever seen, I don't know if people have ever seen, you know, kindergartners working on learning computer science and some of that software engineering and that development, but they get really excited and animated about it. And, you know, it's something I remember, and I won't be able to quote it exactly, but I saw a quote from Zuckerberg, the, you know, founder of Facebook, where he mentioned that in 10 to 15 years, computer science or computer programming will be taught like a second language in schools. And I think we went away from that with the, you know, Windows coming out and lost a lot of that computer programming that I know I did as a young kid in school and working with some of the old DOS language and that. But it's something that we recognize we need to get back to. So that's something unique about our school district. That is there. We also really focus on individualized learning and student growth, very much so like we did in Wheatland. We really strive here in Elkhorn to identify what the instructional level of the student is and make sure that we're providing the instruction at that level so the students can maximize their growth. The elementaries have a wonderful school climate. and culture that is in place. We have a very comprehensive PBIS program, Positive Behavior Intervention Strategies, and we're also incorporating a anti-bullying and harassment program called OLVEAS, and it's a internationally recognized and renowned program, and that is being rolled out into all of our elementary schools. And so we're really excited about that and the positive impact that it's going to have on our students next year as well. Moving into our middle school, our middle school is really unique in many aspects, but one of the avenues that it stands out head and shoulders above most middle schools is that the facility itself was designed and built for middle school philosophy. The students are in teams. They stay with those teams of that team of teachers where they rotate through their different subject areas, but it's really like in a house concept or a pod, and it's a really welcoming, friendly environment, and you know, again, has the beautiful facilities and staff who are really dedicated to the young adolescent learner, and I think that really separates and makes our middle school a special place. Again, they also have the technology integration similar to our elementary schools, where each student has access to the laptop for all of their studies. We also have a rotation of courses along with their core academics, where every student in the building every year participates in automation, robotics, computer science, Spanish, German, art, obviously physical education, and then they have a choice of, you know, band and choir if they choose to participate in that. As we go into the high school level, we have the traditional high school setting. We also have an alternative high school that I mentioned was located on the Gateway campus. And so the traditional high school setting, again, is a very high-achieving school. We are ranked number 21 in the state by U.S. News this past school year, and the highest ranking in Walworth County and in this region. And we are very pleased with that. It's a reflection of the quality of the staff and the leadership over at the high school building. But the high school, it's a very we really focus on developing the student skills, both for post-secondary education or the workforce. We have a lot of offerings where students can earn the college credit if they choose, or, again, just build upon those skills, where they're able to participate in youth apprenticeships and job shadows and really develop skills for the workforce. So we're very proud of that program. And one of our foci is that we really want students to graduate with a credential, and we're working towards the ability to have every student graduate with a professional credential of some type or having completed a youth apprenticeship.
In the area of special education, how does the district stack up in terms of dealing with the special needs of students who qualify for special education?
You know, as far as stacking up in regards to special education, I think we have a phenomenal program, and we have some unique offerings for students in the district as well. We, as most school districts are, we strive to incorporate every student into the classroom. We and make sure that their needs are met in the least restrictive environment possible. We do also partner with the county for Lakeland School for students who have more severe needs and need that additional support. And if they meet that criteria, then they have that opportunity to go to Lakeland School, which is just an amazing facility and program for students. We also have a special emotional behavior program in our school district, which is unique. A lot of schools really have to outsource and send the kids sometimes as far as, you know, a half hour to an hour long ride each way to get to that program. And we've developed and incorporated that right here on our campus, so our students have access to the regular programming as well and are in a more comfortable setting.
In your role as superintendent, how would you compare your role now as superintendent and your role as a district administrator when you were at Wheatland in terms of working with the school board and just that overall relationship?
You know, I think that's a great question. I think one of the things that it's probably, I don't want to say it surprised me, but there's really not a lot of differences between working with the school board in Wheatland or in Elkhorn. Both boards were exceptional. I have an excellent school board here in Elkhorn. And the school board members here in Elkhorn, many of them have been on the board for over a decade. So there's been a lot of stability, a lot of great leadership from the school board. And they do a great job of, you know, setting policy, working with administration to help set the vision of the school district and keep the district moving forward. They've been very supportive. Very helpful in moving the initiatives forward. And I think really as that role of superintendent, it's keeping them informed or apprised and a part of that development of the vision so that we can make sure that we have the community voice and vision implemented here in the school district.
I noticed on your website you have an update on the 2015 referendum. And the thing that I found really fascinating was that on the two questions that the voters voted on, one was the school building and improvement program, which was essentially a $20 million referendum. The second question dealt with the high school athletic facilities. And the big dollar amount, the $20 million referendum passed and the high school athletic facilities did not pass. First of all, did that surprise you? And then maybe if you could just give a quick update on how things are going with respect to the school building and improvement program.
Yes, as far as the surprise, obviously we would have loved to have had them both pass. The question number one passed by a significant margin. I believe it was close to 65% voted yes.
In these days of tight budgets and, you know, Act 10 being in place now and everyone obviously always being concerned about budget, with a referendum for that amount passing with that percentage of people voting in favor, did that surprise you?
Yes and no. Because we had done survey data beforehand to see what the community was willing to support and what the dollar amount was willing to support. So we had worked with school perceptions and we had surveyed the community. We had a great response back from the community. And so we really knew what they were willing to support and what the dollar amount was. The reason why we broke the referendum into two questions is the original financial projections, which we did very conservatively on those projections, showed that the $20 million referendum was getting close to the threshold of what the community was willing to support from a costing standpoint. So the recommendation went to the board to break it into two questions, knowing that typically athletic facilities are going to be more of a challenge to pass typically because not everybody, you know, for whatever reason, sees that as a need or a benefit to all students. I certainly do, but you know, we know that there's that perception piece there. What we found after we developed that recommendation, the board approved to go to referendum with the two questions, is our financial projections, the picture actually was much better, and we easily could have fit both of them well under the threshold of what the community was willing to support. But at that time, it went forward as two questions. And, you know, question number two, the athletic facilities did end up missing by 40 votes, which was like 49, you know, 0.8% to 50.2%. So it was very close on that question as well. The good news is that even with us passing the 20.5 million dollar referendum question, the district has done such a fantastic job, and Mr. Truen, our business manager, structuring our debt, that with debt falling off and with the way the school finance system went this last year, the school tax levy portion actually went down. So we were able to pass the $20.5 million referendum and the tax levy went down. So that was quite an accomplishment.
And that is highly unusual in these days of tight budgets. I mentioned Act 10. How is the district doing? What has been the overall impact from your perspective as superintendent here in the district with respect to Act 10, whether it be retaining good teachers, attracting new teachers?
Yes, I think with Act 10, there's a lot of, you know, it's a lot of change in education. I don't think it's just Act 10, because I think hand in hand with Act 10 was the significant budget reduction. And so sometimes it's hard to delineate, you know, the two. Act 10 itself, I think the big change with that, it has created basically, the way I look at it and compare it, a free agent market, so to speak. So it does allow greater flexibility in the teaching areas that have high needs. We've been able to do some things to, you know, try to help retain staff and keep that in place. We still, we just finished working with staff on a new compensation model this past year and working with a committee and having teacher input. It's different than negotiations because it's not a negotiation, but their input was very valuable. And so from that aspect, I don't think it's so much Act 10, which has flipped things on its head as much as the, you know, $550 per pupil budget reduction that took place several years and has never been restored from a budgetary aspect. So to be honest, I think Act 10 in many aspects gets a really negative rap, but I think it's more so because of the budget cut rather than some of the things that, you know, could be utilized through Act 10 in a positive way that wouldn't. People just don't see, because it's really just been a tool to help mitigate the budget cut that took place.
And my last question is, I'll give you 30 seconds. If someone were listening to this program right now and they were thinking about maybe sending their child to one of the schools here in the district, give me a really great promo piece for any of the schools here in the Elkhorn School District.
Wonderful. What I would say is come and visit the school. Look at the climate and the culture. It is wonderful and exceptional. You'll see students engaged, excited about learning, and teachers who care. And that's so critical, to have a positive voice and a positive influence in a student's life, is having someone who cares about them. And our staff cares, our teachers care, our principals care, and our community cares. Our community gives so much to the school, whether through supporting a referendum or the gifts and donations that we receive on a regular basis. It's a wonderful place to live and a wonderful place to go to school.
Well, I want to thank you once again for being my guest here on Education Matters. And Jason Tadlock, it looks like there's some great things going on here in the Elkhorn School District.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brown.
In closing, I'd like to thank Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Superintendent of Schools in Elkhorn, Jason Tadlock, for joining me this morning on Education Matters. For WGTD-HD, I'm Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page. The following debate between the two Kenosha mayoral candidates in the April 5th election occurred Thursday, March 3rd.
Hello, I'm Len Iquinta, and this is the Kenosha Spring Election Candidates Forum for the Office of Mayor of Kenosha. The rules for the forum are simple. Candidates will be asked questions by me. The questions are of my own choosing and were not shared with anyone in advance of this event. Thank you to all who submitted questions for consideration, including many of the candidates. The order of speaking was determined by a coin toss conducted by me in public just before the start of this broadcast. We have an audience here at Gateway Technical College in the WGTD studio. They may also submit questions in writing, which will be collected by staff and forwarded to me. The audience has been asked to keep silence to save time and in the interests of fairness to all. This forum is co-sponsored by Kenosha Community Media and WGTD Public Radio for Southeastern Wisconsin. Both organizations will be providing recordings of this event on their digital pages. See their websites for details. And now to the mayoral candidates for Kenosha. The candidates are John Antaramian and Bob Johnson. John won the coin toss, and I will read his bio first, and then he will give an opening statement. I will also read Bob Johnson's bio. At the same time, he will give the second opening statement. They will continue talking for about 40 minutes as we ask questions, and at the conclusion, we will ask each candidate to make a one-minute closing statement. So, to begin, welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
John Antaramian was the 34th mayor of the city of Kenosha, retiring in 2008 after 16 years, the longest service of any